enter if you dare this ghastly conversation of teens fraught with despair and recent lacerations. Final girl, chase after her, don't let her get away. But first, the Slumber Podcast Massacre.
Welcome to Slumber Podcast Massacre with TNA. I gotta get very serious right now. That's Tim.
I gotta be really serious right now. That's Andy.
And this is a podcast about horror. Every week, Tim and I get together. We talk about a different movie from the horror genre, from your well-known classic down to that rare gem with an extra tongue, ear, and three fingers at the back of your video store shelf. We're kind of concluding our rough listener request month that's lasted 6 weeks with from 1999, another film from overseas. It's Audition. Tim, what's the worst audition you've ever had?
Me personally auditioning.
Yeah.
I know.
Right, well, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You giving an audition? Like, well, facilitating one?
Rarely do I give bad ones, but the worst one was for a show called, I think it's The Foreigner?
Yeah.
Okay. And
this is in high school?
No. Yeah. Well, yes, yeah. but at our theater, not the high school's theater.
Damn. I was going to gloat because I was in the one in high school.
Right. Yeah. So you got in. So it is possible to get into that show. Then,
it is
what you're
it
saying.
Is,
okay.
Yeah.
So I was auditioning and I was still pretty young. And I mean, I had fine chops at that point, but there was a bit of stage direction written in front of a line, which is what you'll see in sort of parentheses that kind of guide the actor and what the writer was looking to achieve in the reading of the line. And the stage direction was convulses with laughter, which I took far too literally.
You're like, I had a seizure.
I literally was. And when they were like, wait, stop, because this is what made it embarrassing was that the people auditioning me even knew that, like, I could do better. Like, I clearly misunderstood something. So it got. And I tried it, I don't know, maybe three times.
Yeah.
But I still thought that, like, what they didn't want was the convulsion. Like, I didn't realize that was the problem they were having.
Right.
So they have one of the directors actually come on. This is in the middle of the audition. Comes onto the stage.
Oh, man.
Like, let me show you what I'm talking about. But when he read the line, I felt like he, too, was convulsing. So I'm like, oh, I get what you want. And so I'm like, yeah, I got it now. And then convulsed even harder. Like, I was literally like, do you remember the Beat It video where that one guy's like, oh,
yeah, where he does the breakdancing and then the shake?
Right. I was literally doing that and just laughing maniacally. And it must have been the most unsettling thing that anyone's ever seen.
Oh, man.
But
when
now,
was that? When did they do? Was that before the high school did it or after?
I think so. I think it was before. Wow. But no, it might have been after. It was right around the same time.
Oh, okay.
Had to have been. But the worst audition I've seen was there was this woman. This was for Fiddler on the Roof.
Uh-huh.
And there was a woman who said that she was Jewish. And I'm not, I feel like I'm not insulting anybody by saying this because she was so ridiculous. But she gets up on the stage and you're supposed to have a song prepared just so they can. I mean, even if you just sang happy birthday so that they could hear your voice. But instead of doing that, she decided to launch into this kind of monologue that felt very made up and not even necessarily like culturally accurate. But it was, I don't even remember what she was saying, but she had on these finger symbols.
Oh my God.
On both hands, like little symbols, literally like rings on her finger. And she would be like, and it's in the middle of the fall of the year that we step outside into the crisp air and we sing havala, 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 and starts like doing like the finger syllables or symbols and is, I think, just making up Yiddish words. Like maybe they were real, but she's like just like moving cat-like around the stage and literally just. It was bizarre. It was kind
that
of
sounds awesome.
Well, there are those.
So this is not someone who is like
cast? No.
Yeah, or like prolific. Because there are some people in the community, especially around that time, I could have totally seen doing who are still respected and work.
Nobody that we know. Okay. Yeah, nobody that we know. But no, it was crazy. And there was a time, I think I've even talked about this before, very, very nice woman. I mean, she was one of those like quintessential, like, I'm going to come down to the community theater and I'm a bored housewife and, you know, my husband doesn't know I'm alive and my children hate me, but I'm going to forge my own path. And that sounds really specific, but it's a lot more common than you'd think.
Yeah.
And so she's down there, pretty lady, looked nice on stage. Starts singing the Cheers theme song.
Oh, my God.
Poor thing. Gets about maybe a sentence out and then just starts shaking and crying and ran out of the building.
Oh.
And I felt terrible. They ended up casting her anyway. I mean, just gave her cast, literally. Yeah. Like, she might have had one.
You need to, yeah. Because, yeah, you know, you're coming out for it, you know.
Sure.
She wants to do it. So
yeah.
Give her an opportunity to.
We'll put her on props or something. Yeah. Like, we'll find something for her to do.
Get comfortable in the space.
Yeah. She was like a, I would say like a voluptuous Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh.
So they found, yeah, they found a place for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was directing this show?
Just exactly who you would think would be directing it.
DC and SH?
Well, if no, you know what? They might not. You know what? Come to think of it.
Initials.
Yeah. They, if they weren't directed, they were heavily involved.
Okay.
But yeah, it was that. But
I love,
yeah,
watching a bad audition. And it feels pompous to say, not that I have not had my own bad auditions, but man, like, at least knowing we're good enough for community theater and watching people audition who are not.
Yeah.
Is, it's, you know, I give props for coming out and,
sure,
following your dreams, but man, when you're not good at your dreams, it's kind of funny sometimes.
Well, exactly. And thank God, like, the sad part about it is that I'm sure that they are normally functioning people in real life.
Right.
Like, they don't do like spastic movements and completely unrealistic, like when they say something to someone
right,
in life. But you get them on a stage, oh, and you just see people act in the most bizarre fashion. And it's crazy. Like, it's kind of its own little social biosphere in and of itself. Like,
yeah,
an audition on stage is very strange.
Yes. But, you know, it's like if you see a piece of dramatic art, a lot of the times it is a person who's being over the top and they're, you know, conveying these loud emotions or whatever. But what they lose, it's like, that's within the context of what they're doing. You know, it's like, you don't do the whole show that way. There's,
yeah,
like one part that's interesting, but if you just go up and do an audition of anything like that, are like, well, I have to like really bring it and like layer this thing 18 different ways. That doesn't work.
Right. And yeah, well, yeah. And
just the most subtle thing is the best.
The thing of it is that every now and then you'll get really lucky. And the things that we're describing were like somebody acts completely unnatural, like in a way that just no human ever would. And sometimes every now and then, if you're really lucky, you'll get a two-person scene and both of them are like that.
Oh.
To where – and we – obviously, we're professionals. We're compassionate people. We can't just turn to each other like we'd like to and say, can you fucking believe right, what is happening up there right now? We'd love to do that. So we exchange looks.
Oh, yeah.
Just little sideways glances of like usually like open wide eyed, like looking down like, dude, what the fuck is that? I've seen some of those before. And it was, there was one in particular. It was for a View from the Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And it was so good that I never, ever wanted it to end. It was if you had somebody that is like, I'm sort of interested in hallucinogens, but I don't really want to take them.
Yeah.
Just be there for that scene because I felt like I was on a different planet.
Oh.
I'll tell you later who the two people in the scene were.
Can you give me initials? Maybe not.
No, I can't. MJ.
Okay. Okay.
And GM, who is actually known as like a pretty prolific guy.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm mouthing. Hopefully, like,
riveting. Again, I'd like to thank the listeners who are new here and that we've now lost.
I mean, I would have used my telepathy if you were open to it, but yeah, that was, oh my God, that was crazy. But yes, there are strange things that happen, but there's also beautiful things. I'll tell you what, it's really, really tough to beat connecting with another actor on stage in a performance. I mean, it's a feeling unlike anything else. It's, honest to God, I don't mean that in a pompous way. I mean that it's such a bizarre phenomenon, because think about it. It's two of you, or two or three or four, however many, you know, hundreds of people watching, hopefully, and it's something that you've worked on. And sometimes there are moments, there are ingredients. It's, you feel the energy off the audience, which, by the way, some scientists should measure that, because it's real. I mean, you can feel a vibe off of an audience when they're connected or not. And then when you guys are just hitting your paces and you're just in sync, it's beautiful. However, when you're able to connect like that, maybe not ever on that perfect of a level, but any sort of real true connection in an audition feels like magic.
Yeah.
Feels like you're superstars up there, because everybody's fumbling, you know, and I mean, us included. But if you find a scene partner and it's like, holy shit, this is the audition and we are fucking kicking ass.
Yeah.
That's an awesome feeling.
I had an audition like that. Dude, I auditioned for a show. Now, I feel I was personally slighted out of this show. That's just my opinion. But I did a scene with another person. It was the only time we read together, and we had read with other people. And I kid you not, I even talked to one other person I don't remember what her title was at the time, but she was like working in the office on the side of the room,
yeah,
of where we're having auditions. She was like, I literally like had to like lean, like she did the thing where she like leaned back, like, who is doing that? Like, who's doing that scene? And she was like, you guys were amazing together, and neither of us got cast.
What?
Yeah.
What show is this? You can say it. Can
Rabbit
you say
Hole? It?
Oh, I've heard about it. Listen. I've heard about
there's a lot of politics in theater, baby.
I've heard about a couple of people that were really good that did not get cast. Yeah. So
that, but I still liked that show and I saw it. I held no ill will toward anyone who was cast in that show.
And you know what? Who the person?
I will say the guy who got cast in the part I was auditioning for said I gave a masterclass of an audition. So,
well, I don't doubt that. Man, you're a great actor. And you know what's funny about your acting is you I feel like you snuck up on the world. Like you were always great, but your talent initially when we were kids was like a likability and a charisma, and you just had like a fun magnetism about you that people just liked seeing on stage. But you evolved into something far more complex than that. And far more natural, to where I've been in scenes with you and been envious of just whether you're faking it or not or whatever, but the level of naturalness that you've achieved in some scenes that I've shared the stage with you in is like, I'm in the scene and I'm expected to do a job,
yeah,
but I find myself watching you and I've been just fucking dead impressed on many occasions of
what. Well, back at you, Tim, you hit levels of emotion that I'm afraid to tread upon. So,
well, that's kind of the strengths. We have our I think what it is like your natural resistance to bullshit in life plays out well on the stage, because guess what? When it comes to theater people, you don't get a whole lot of that. You don't get a whole lot of down to earth when you're talking about theater people.
Nothing like ruins my love of theater more than the people you have to do it with. Right?
Exactly, though. It's true.
So much.
And
also, I've made some amazing friends through the theaters. I can't say that, but the bad ones hit hard.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever thrown an audition on purpose? We'll talk about this movie, I swear, in a minute.
Yeah, right. No, you know what? I don't. You know, I've thrown parts where I didn't want a certain part.
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but I'll give them the goods.
I tried doing that, and they were still like, please play this part. And I was like.
But you know what, though? I will say this. there have been many times, and shame on me for not getting it, but there have been many times where I have been cast in roles that I was like, you're a fucking idiot. Like, didn't you see me doing that other role? Like, why are you casting me in this? I wanted that other thing. And honest to God, 9 times out of 10, the director was right. And by the time we get to the end of the run of the show, I'm like, holy shit, thank God they didn't cast me in that other role.
Right.
You know, and that happens a lot.
Yeah.
But that's what the director's there for.
Yeah.
So.
That's why I like directing. I feel like I'm a good... I can cast a show well.
Yeah,
and you rely on our my friend Justin, my co-director mainly. We've co-directed before, but sure. he's my regular.
Yeah, I would say that.
He's able to finesse it better than I am in a rehearsal. But I feel like I'm really good at picking a cast.
Yeah. No, you are. You are. And yeah, and I've seen you when we've casted together before, I've seen you see some things that I didn't see, but you were right about.
Yeah.
But then again, I was right about that one that, and I don't blame you for being like, this is a big mistake, but then, well, not a big mistake, but you just weren't sure. And then when he hit the stage, finally in rehearsals or about
Well, he was listen, perfect. Not even rehearsals. It was the like night before we opened. And I was like, where the fuck is this guy been?
Right. And he was great.
He was great. He was great. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know that there are other people listening to this. We've forgotten about you. I promise.
This is also like a time in my life where I'm like, I'm done with theater. And the last week I've been like, but am I?
Right.
But am I?
And this is the stuff that you can write in and ask about, with the exception of the bird story. But this is the stuff that you can write in and ask about and say like, okay, what were you guys, or share something. You know, you're not being like a braggart or, you know, being egotistical to say like, hey, I do theater too. Like, let me tell you about this one thing that I had. Yep. We'd love to hear that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love to hear theater stories.
Right. It's just, theater we happen to be crazy. The ones. Yeah. We're the ones here with the microphones right now. Okay. So sorry.
Probably a better theater experience than you had, like more successful, more awards won.
Well, yeah, I'm the bad boy. I'm the bad boy of our region of theater.
That's true.
So, yeah. You know, and I'm just kind of, yeah. I'm that, like, tragic character that, like, doesn't look for trouble, but trouble finds him. You know.
The audience really sympathizes with at the end. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Cool. Auditions are fun.
They are.
Did you ever see that Mr. Show sketch, The Audition? It's one of the best sketches ever written. The Can I Use This Chair?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Quick, yeah. Just everyone right now, pause this episode. Go look up Mr. Show, The Audition. Watch that. Some of the best comedy writing in the last 40 years.
Yes.
And a simple premise. And that grew out of a joke. I just listened to Bob Odenkirk's book, and he talks about that. And he's like, it was a joke on accident. And someone went, oh, this thing, there's some legs here. And then it just grew, like, just organically in, like, minutes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, just grew into one of the great sketches.
Well, it must just be fertile ground because, yeah, that is an excellent sketch. But just to show, like, how fertile that ground is, even fucking Joey's scene with the man bag on Friends auditioning, where he's auditioning with the man bag. Like, yeah. I mean, it's Friends, for God's sake. It's not the most evolved comedy.
How do you know a Friends scene?
I ended up watching all of Friends.
Why?
Way after every. That's how I do, because I'm just a rebel and I'll never ever be any good. And so I can't watch it when the whole world is there to enjoy it with. I have to watch it like alone in the dark, laughing to myself. But no, I've seen all of the Friends episodes like probably 3 times over.
Wow.
Yeah. There's actually some. I'll tell you this.
Some really dark things I don't
David
know about
Schwimmer,
you.
Like, I mean, we can, I know people love to rip on Friends here and there. Like a lot of younger people will just like name a funny show and they'll just be like, literally, I have not laughed once. Like they'll say that about The Office or whatever.
Well, no, that's the one. The Office is like echelon.
You know what?
But yeah,
you
haven't ever they'll be like, I watched Cheers.
Right.
Cheers was funny.
But you know what, though? Sometimes I'll go back, and we've talked about this before, the worst offender is SNL. And I'll go back and watch old seasons of, like, 80s SNL, and I'll be like, my God, like, this
depends on which year of the 80s.
Oh, good point.
Late 80s, incredible. Early 80s, cancel it.
Right. Hey, did you hear it? And I just want to say this real quick because it's kind of important because it's SNL is like a – and we will get to the movie and Japan and everything. It's a long flight. That's why we're doing this. But did you hear – that there is very good potential. Now, I don't know what year are they on. Are they on 50 now?
No, that'll be in three years.
Yeah. Okay. So if they close out at 50, let's say.
Yeah.
I know that guys our age, people our age, like to think that SNL is sort of like this weird battery for Earth that it always has to be plugged right, in or else everything just ends, you know, because it's been around so long. But I mean, at some point, are you okay with SNL ending, or do you think that that goes against the model that they of perseverance that they've shown where it's like, no, you push through until you hit gold again?
I mean, unless it's like not doing well.
What if Lorne Michaels isn't involved anymore?
I don't know. You know, I can't say he's made the best decisions every time. That I don't know. How much Lorne Michaels, you know, is what that show is. Not that he's not a huge part. I don't know how to like not underplay
right
his significance to that show.
He's got to babysit but at the all same these people.
Time, yeah, at the same time, I mean, you have the best of the best who are – it's not like he's going around like, oh, I was at this little dingy nightclub and I picked this guy out of obscurity. Like, I've been to enough, like, Saturday Night Live auditions in Chicago. Like, you can go and watch it. And people come up and they fucking parade up on stage. They do 4 minutes and then that's it. There was one guy, Luke Knoll, who was on for 1 year. He was on like one sketch, but I like saw his audition, and then he got cast the next year. So it's like there will still be the people there to do it, and unless there's something of more importance, I guess that you need to put on at 10:30 Saturday night on network television, go for it. I don't know.
When did you stop watching every single Saturday night?
I still do.
Really?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I don't watch it on Saturday night. But
really?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
No, I think that's
and
cool.
Listen, Saturday Night Live every year. Saturday Night Live, you can't judge it until like 5 years later. Because, yeah, a episode is going to have some stinkers in it. Go back and look at every golden era you think exists of Saturday Night Live. And every episode will be like, oh, there was like one good sketch in that episode.
Well, that's true. And you know,
but you have a nice little compilation tape you can watch 25 years after the fact. You go, why aren't they doing it like this anymore? This was front to end, nonstop hilarity.
Good point. But you know what sucks about that is that SNL has such a fucking gorilla grip on, which I love that phrase. I heard an adult film actress use that phrase to describe part of her anatomy, but it's got such a gorilla grip on the scenes that it or even the episodes that it lets out into the world that there is one sketch that I am fucking dying to see. And I know who was star. I know who was hosting. I can tell you exactly what episode it was, but I can't access it because even if they show you that, like a condensed version, like a Reader's Digest version of that, it doesn't have that skit in it.
Oh.
Drives me nuts.
I feel like we've talked about this before.
Yeah, it's Matthew Broderick was hosting.
Yeah.
And he's doing like this kind of like stuffy, like comedians through the ages show.
Yeah.
And he has on not a marijuana comedy duo, but a PCP comedy duo. And it is fucking hysterical. And it is Tracy Morgan and Will Ferrell playing, and it is absolutely the best thing I've ever seen in my life.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So Audition, it's a movie from 1999. Let's get through the Wikipedia facts and talk about this thing.
How far do we go?
To those who love the banter and hate the talk of the movies, congratulations. This episode's for you. Anyway, and we like this movie. I don't know why we haven't jumped into it.
Let's talk about it.
Okay, You say you've got pronunciations. I'm going to do my best.
Yeah, no,
show in a row where I was just like, let's go for it. Okay, so this was written by Daisuke Tengen. I throw in a little affectation there. Sorry.
I don't have that name here, but go ahead. Okay,
directed by Takashi Miike.
Yeah, close. Yeah,
okay, awesome. And it stars Ryo Ishibashi.
Oh, you did your homework.
I didn't.
You're doing great.
And Ihi Shiina.
Yeah. You did fine. That was
Hawaiian.
You did
but,
great.
You know, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
You did awesome.
Financials. No idea what the budget was. Made $130,000 in the U.S., but it's a foreign film.
Yeah.
Who knows?
What's that yen or whatever?
Let's do Nansum, and then we can get into some spoilers. Shikaru Oyama, nailed it, is a widower who doesn't do much in his life. His son, noticing how sad his father is, recommends he remarry. Not all that enthused about re-entering the dating pool, a friend who happens to be a film producer comes up with a plan. They will stage a fake audition for a film in order for Shigaru to meet a woman he could marry. He is smitten by one of the auditioners, Asami Yakazuki. That one I did practice, but I fucked it up. Due to her quiet nature and emotional depth, the two begin a courtship. And while Shigaru learns of her unfortunate upbringing, he also begins discovering holes in her story, indicating Asami may not be the person he suspects her to be. Is it all part of his own guilt and paranoia, or did Shigaru choose the wrong person to fulfill his role at the audition?
Nice.
That was a rough one to wrap back around.
Yeah. Maybe she had a tough time growing up because her name was so hard to pronounce. Did you know this, though? That it's their, like, if we talk about the director, Takashi Miike.
Uh-huh.
His first name is Miike.
Yes, they're all kind of flipped.
And I didn't really, that's kind of a new thing. Like, they used to flip it for us.
Right.
To make us more comfortable.
Right.
But now they've gone back and they're like, can we just fucking do this the way that we do it?
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest. A lot of these, I don't know which are the first and last names.
I think it's okay. Because he does,
because Shigaru gets called Oyama a lot in this movie.
Well, that's true.
But then reading the synopsis, it's like, and then Shigaru does this and Shigaru does that. And I was right. Like, okay.
Yeah, we can say male.
My
lead.
Own cultural ignorance shines brightly through the darkness. But you know what? No, this one even I'm not worried about.
We can say the male lead.
Right.
We've done it many times. Yes. So here's a movie.
Can I say real quick?
Go ahead.
How refreshing was this movie? This was a nice, I was just like, oh, audition.
Well.
Ah.
I know it was more refreshing for you than me.
I didn't expect this to be the palate cleanser because next week we kind of have one that we were like, there. Because this movie's reputation is probably was up there at levels of your like Human Centipedes or
sure
Serbian films.
Yeah.
Of like, this movie's fucked up. It's disturbing. Good luck watching it. And
right.
I mean, nothing fucked up happens until there's 15 minutes left in the movie. A few fucked up things, but like no horror until like 15 minutes left. And on top of that, wonderful movie. Like a great story about a guy struggling with his own loneliness and then his own lies. And it's great.
It is great. And I'm going to say something. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but this movie belongs to the millennials. Like this is them. Like this is their thing. Like this was the beginning of recognizable J horror anyhow. And it was the beginning of what became, I think, unfortunately labeled as torture porn. But this is a movie that
did inspire torture porn.
Yes.
I would not say this is at all.
And by millennials, I mean elder millennials. Like I'm talking about people who are right now in 2022 are going to be like roughly in their late 30s, probably more likely like right around 40.
Right.
So like the first generation of millennials, like this is kind of their thing and it's awesome. It comes from a really interesting guy. And I'm going to call him by his first name, Miike, because I think that sounds pretty. Fascinating guy.
Why don't you just call him Mike?
Mike, yeah. Mike Takashi cranks this shit out like you wouldn't believe. It's true. This guy has a rule usually of 2-week shooting schedules. This one he really like overshot it, went 3 weeks.
Right.
But
a real slog.
He cranks out an average of 6 films a year, which is unprecedented. And he is just an enthusiast for – he's a little bit of an upstart. I mean, he's – I'm not going to say the guy is an anarchist, but he likes playing by his own rules. He likes doing – just kind of keeping people off kilter. Like he'll do children's shows, and then he'll do a movie which he's also equally known as well for, which is Ichi the Killer, which is a ton of gore and a ton of violence, and almost to the level of like just almost cartoon level violence and gore. So this is something that for him to do this movie is a lot of restraint. It's a lot of refinement. I'm not going to call it perfect, but the ways that it isn't are totally forgivable because it's a movie. I don't know if I've ever watched a movie that got so much better as the movie went on. And that's not to say that the beginning was bad.
Yeah.
More impactful, more meaningful, you know, because the first half of this movie, like you described, certainly without horror, but almost even purposely like banal. Like it's, I mean, it's kind of like a paint by numbers on purpose, which is a really ballsy choice to make. But yeah, it's just almost like he's purposely feeding you a generic, like, the wife died, you know, good guy raised his son and they're really sweet. And a little bit of,
yeah, he's not like a shitty person.
No,
like,
God, no.
While what he does is questionably ethical, you know.
Yeah.
To set up a fake on it. I shouldn't say questionably. It's really shitty. Like it's very shitty.
It is, but it's treated in such a sweet way.
Yeah, he's kind of reluctant to it, but as you know, all you need is someone else going, it's fine, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, well, okay, fine.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. And now I want to say real quickly, and we should get this out of the way real fast in case somebody's not used to watching either foreign films or certainly Japanese foreign films. And I'm not going to sit here and say that I mean, J-horror is not my level of expertise when or not my forte of expertise as far as horror goes. But one thing that is a real shame about Japanese movies is they tend to have awful English translation. Like they make people sound like robots.
Oh.
Like it would in the translation, it sounds like they would say something like, that woman is very complex. I think a relationship with her would be challenging on many levels.
Right.
Like, I mean, oftentimes we miss out on a little bit of the nuance there because we don't speak Japanese. Not to say that you shouldn't watch this movie because it's got subtitles that are a little robotic.
Yeah.
You still pick it up.
Because I know what you're talking about. There can be. The two languages don't translate very literally with each other.
Right.
So there's a lot of interpretation. But yeah, I felt this came off fine.
Well, and in all in thanks to how great the actors are.
Yes.
Because we, even if the line as we're reading it in English sounds a bit robotic, we can feel what it really means.
Yeah.
Because the actors are so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a funny thing that you said about the whole audition thing being unethical. You know, I have so much to say about that on so many different levels that I'm going to literally break it up throughout the show. But the first level is, as a decent human being, if you thought of a man who's going to try to pick his future partner through a ruse of an audition where they think that they're auditioning for a role, even though they do say that like they are actually maybe thinking about turning it into a movie. So it's not completely fake, but it's mostly for one buddy to get his other buddy, somebody to be with. it's handled in such a comical way, like a light comical way, that I'm like, this almost feels like silly American comedy. Like the quick like cuts.
The parade of yes. all the auditioners.
Yeah. They make it. They don't make it slimy.
No.
They don't make it like.
I mean, it is slimy, though. They're like standing in there taking their clothes off.
Well, by
all
their own choice.
What? Yeah. But it's under the guise of, I'm not saying like, hey, in order to be in a movie, you got to do this.
Right.
But they're not going to be in a movie.
Well, right. But I guess
there's
what I'm saying.
Not going to be a movie.
But what I'm saying is I'm not questioning the ethics of them doing it. But the way that the film presents it is very light.
Sure.
Like it's light humor.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And so I just kind of took it as that. Not to say that it is, but they present it in kind of a fun way.
Yeah. It's like that scene in The Commitments where they're like doing band auditions.
Now let me remind you of a certain Toni Braxton music video where there is a group of women watching as male models are brought in and uh-huh. dancing and flexing in front of them. And they're like, no, not that one. Like, oh yeah, that
got
one.
Got him, Tim. You got
him. I'm balancing the scales. That's all I'm doing.
50-50.
I'm balancing the scales.
You don't think maybe that video was some sort of cheeky response to like the industry and how they feel constantly?
Well, it might have been.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll tell you what, though. Every single one of the. And for anybody that remembers that Toni Braxton video that I'm talking about.
I don't even know what you're talking
some
about.
Good looking dudes in that video.
I bet. Yeah.
But anyhow. Yeah, so I think that there's a lot to be taken, and I'm not going to try to brush away the framework of this movie that lends itself very much to a lot of questions of gender inequality. I don't know this well enough to comment on it. I feel like it's unfair for me to say anything about it, but from what I read, Japan specifically has a big problem with objectification of women.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know a whole lot about that.
No.
But I
me
mean,
neither. I do know historically it seems to be an issue.
Seems to come up a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it certainly could be a comment.
But only
on
Japan.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, they gave us Mr. Miyagi, so it all works out in the end. No, I was going to say real quick, and I'm not going to go off on this as much as I thought that I was when I was first thinking about it, but I did have an interesting introduction as a kid to Japanese culture. I had a couple Japanese neighbors that I was really close to, at least one of them. And I always had an interest in Asian culture, and I'm going to make a clear point about this. I'm actually going to strip away my ego, and rather than talk for 15 minutes about my Japanese neighbors,
yeah.
I'm going to ask you a real serious question. I am guilty of maybe giving some movies a little bit more of a favorable review because they had an element about them that I like personally.
Sure.
Maybe there's an actor in it that I like, or maybe it has to do with a certain topic of a certain people or whatever. That right. I'm going to turn a blind eye.
I mean, you're saying this as the only person I know who's ever seen 7 seconds or 8 seconds.
8 seconds, yes. In the movie theater, twice. So, yes. And I also saw Buffy the Vampire Slayer 7 times in the theater.
Oh, man. That's a good movie, though.
So, yeah. So I'm guilty of that. The question is, are there some things in this movie, and I believe that this is rhetorical, while 90% of this movie is amazing, I wonder if some people have a little bit of a foreign fetish that might make them gloss over, and I'm not, maybe I'm not even speaking specifically about this movie, but that people might say like, oh, I'm going to automatically turn more of a blind eye to certain quality issues because it's Japanese.
Right.
Because it's foreign.
Right.
There's one character in particular in this movie that is so cartoonish that I feel like the quality of the rest of the movie drops when he is in it, and that is the dance instructor. It feels really cheap and like it, it's like everything that they've achieved with these other characters just kind of, it gets silly with him.
Yeah. Yeah. But also at the same time, I mean, I totally get what you're saying, because he is probably the goofiest. He does a lot of like leering and, you know.
Yeah. I wish the audience could see your face, what you just did there. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But at the same time, I think he's introduced at a point where you're like, is this guy even real? Like, is he really talking? Because he comes, like, when we were first introduced to the dance instructor, he like, go, because, you know, she said she trained in ballet for 12 years. So he's kind of like going to investigate this place she played ballet. When he gets to the place, it's like an open front with just like a board nailed to it. You know, it's not like a tight, secured building. So it's like an abandoned building. And he goes in, and then there's just a, like, the dance instructors in there playing piano. So to me, I was not like, I didn't take that literally, you know. And, but not to say there's much figurative about it. A lot of like the second half of this movie is a lot of, is this really happening? Is he really experiencing this? Is this maybe some sort of manifestation of clues he's putting together? Something like that. There's like one scene when they're in that white restaurant, they're like super white diner-ish kind of restaurant. And it's just, you know, it's just profiles of them talking to each other. But in that scene, and I don't know if this was, I don't know why they did it this way, because there are these really quick cuts that you can barely notice. So I'm like, but it would be like, it happens three times in a 5-second scene. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, did they either get three good takes of this one line and cut it up into the best parts of it? Or is this like the, because it happens earlier on, or is this part of a, you know, a unreliable narrator scenario? Yeah,
sure. No, that's a great point. And I think that really turns me on to an exciting element of these films. This probably goes back, maybe I first started really thinking about this with Schenectady, that why more movies don't take more risks with a little bit of jumbling of reality.
Yeah.
And this movie does a great job of it, because guess what? It does next to none of it for a huge chunk right. of the beginning. And it's a great choice, because when they do start to mess a little bit with reality, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's not done to the point where you are just throw up your hands and say, well, I don't know what the fuck is going on
right.
or what's real. Like you're
invested enough in these people to where you want to see what the fuck's happening to them.
And you've got a tight enough gorilla grip on what you feel is the true narrative, even though you're seeing some other things,
yeah.
so that you never feel like you're completely out of sorts.
Right.
Like you can tell when something is a sort of like
when the dance instructor shows back up in her apartment, I'm like, okay, this is not
sure.
He's not there.
Yes. No, true. But you know what's funny about that? How much of our own reality actually mirrors that? Like, you might sure. think that, like, I am not psychotic, so I go throughout my life and I'm always keyed into reality. But maybe someday you walk into, like, your neighborhood bar, and in your mind you're thinking about, like, Vince Neil on top of, like, a bunch of burning cars in the Dr. Feelgood video as you walk into the bar. Like, how much are you really connected to reality at that point okay. when all you're picturing is Vince Neil in a junkyard? But we do this all the time, right? Like,
sounds very specific and personal. Well,
I just literally, that was off the top of my head. But I'm just saying, like, we walk through life like we're ultra, like, high definition connected to every bit of specific stimuli that surrounds us at any given time.
Yeah.
But we're always in our own head, right?
Sure.
I mean, there's moments where that creeps in a little bit yeah, more than others.
Life is you can only say for sure what I perceive as reality.
Right.
What you yourself.
And we
you can be not real, but I don't know. Everything I know about everything I've experienced tells me that you are real.
Absolutely.
But I could definitely be a brain in a jar and this is a simulation.
And even if we don't take it that far, even if we just assume that there is a set reality that we've all agreed upon,
yeah.
I'm just saying our minds wander
sure.
in it throughout a day, right?
If it were an Olympic sport, Tim.
Right. So when you have a movie like this that starts to play a little bit with that linear narrative, I'm kind of starting to wonder why more movies don't do that, because it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And it almost, it's not only fascinating, but it makes things incredibly emotional. There is a series of dates that this couple goes on after the audition. And the dates are with our lead actress being very demure. Mm-hmm. You know, she's even got like her head like sort of tucked down most of the time, almost to the point where she's going to give herself bad posture at some point or other.
Well, but there's one shot in this movie that is, and it's awesome.
Yes.
It looks so creepy. And that's early on. This is one of those.
Oh, I know the one you're talking
you're
about.
Like,
oh, we're going to talk about the bag.
Oh, yeah.
but what I'm saying is there's this really, and here's the thing. They couldn't have hit the same emotional note if, I don't care if Shakespeare wrote the scene linearly from the beginning. What we needed to see was the scene played, or the scenes played with her speaking in a way that she thinks that she is not going to put him off, that she is not going to tell the truth about her life. She's going to say what he wants to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But later on in the film, towards the end, we actually get a version of those very same scenes, but with her giving an honest reaction and an honest answer to when you're on a first date, to where instead of saying like, oh, you know, my parents don't really live around here and we don't talk all that much, to saying like, I was abused on the regular and nobody cared. And like, and what it made me think about was, it was very sad, because it was like, if people were just a little bit more honest about their lives, it's like, he probably would have been okay with it.
Yeah.
Like, she was afraid to say it, but if she had said it, it probably would have been all right.
Yeah.
And maybe she could work through it or whatever. But this movie really plays with these sort of, I don't want to call it alternate reality, because they're not trying to be like weird about it. They're just saying, it's more metaphor than anything.
Yeah.
I found that really, really endearing. So let me ask you this. Before the movie gets crazy, as you've mentioned, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's maybe, what is it, 20 minutes?
It's like the last 20 minutes, okay. Yeah.
Did you enjoy the movie prior to that 20 minutes, thinking that you were going to watch a horror movie and it was devoid of horror?
Totally. Oh, okay. Yes, totally. And this was a movie where, yeah, again, all I knew was the premise of it. So to me, I thought this movie was, like, if you were to say, what, without having seen it, what's this movie about? And I would have said, a girl goes to audition, doesn't get the part, and so she tortures the director for the rest of the movie. That's what, like, just hearing, I knew someone got tortured in it, you know, but that's like the premise that I knew, which is not the premise of this movie.
No.
At all. But yeah, I was just, I don't know, I was really into, yeah, like the performances, yeah, the story itself is not anything groundbreaking. Maybe it's because I still knew something was coming. Like, if I had gone into this not knowing this was horror or there was horror elements in it, I don't know what I've been drawn into it. I don't know. That's a good question. Because it is the interesting thing is that she's fucked up, mm-hmm. right? If it were just like an old guy trying to trick a girl into marrying him, that wasn't a comedy from the 80s.
We right.
can't make that comedy yes. these days. But yeah, then I don't know. I don't know if I'd have been that into it.
And it's funny because you're right. The interesting, and it's not to say that they don't do some interesting things along the way, but it's very subtle. For example, you have two guys talking in a bar, two friends, and they're talking about women and they're talking about dating and they're talking about what kind of woman you would be interested in. And then if you look at the frame of the shot, there is a woman sitting at the bar this entire time. and she's in the bottom right corner of the frame. And you have those two guys sort of blindly talking about like their ideal woman or whatever. And it's just almost humorous where it's like, funny, guys, there is actually a woman sitting in the room with you. If you right. really wanted to talk to her, then you could. But they're so caught up in their own fantasy.
Yeah.
Like Weird Science style that, and even to the point where directly in front of them, purposely, there is a bartender shaking a drink that is very kind of almost to the level of annoyance where it's like, hey, guys, there's a woman behind me. And it's expertly done, but it's so subtle. You could see that scene and just say like, well, that's the bartender doing bartender things. But there's a reason why that woman's in the frame. Otherwise, you just have a close up on those two dudes.
Yeah.
So there's cool stuff happening, but it's very, very subtle. Speaking of subtlety, we'll get to the nitty gritty now. I warned you earlier. This movie, I don't feel is about gender, misogyny or feminism. There's certainly elements there, and to say that there aren't is silly, but it's not the main thing. The main thing about this movie is I love his son. Is the character of his son
rules
is fantastic.
He's a biologist or paleontologist kind of thing. He had a wooden stegosaurus skeleton on his shelf. I had that exact same model.
Oh, that's awesome! But he's a kid though. He's like maybe like 16.
Yeah, I had this when I was like 6.
Okay, right,
but. Still, right. The Stegosaurus was my favorite, but I was like, oh my God. Like, I know that. It was like one of those, like, come on a sheet of wood
yeah.
and you punch it out
yeah.
and then assemble it.
And those were harder than they looked,
yes,
by the way.
They were.
I did that in seventh grade.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. You have a movie called Audition. And you have this guy and his buddy cooking up this goofy ass scheme about we're going to hold this fake audition. We're going to find you a new wife and all these things. And then you have this almost invisible little subplot of his son. And his son has a girl over one mm-hmm. night. And they talk a little bit about like he's the one who says, Dad, I think you should get a girlfriend and that sort of thing. So they have a really tender relationship with each other.
Yeah.
It's very nice. So he has this one very cute schoolgirl over, and they're talking about dinosaurs. Now, I remember thinking as I was watching it, I'm like, that's kind of a funny topic because it's not like they're 6-year-olds, right? It's not like the age where kids are like, dinosaurs are the greatest thing ever, and there will never be anything cooler like beer or sex. But they think that dinosaurs are the greatest thing. So I'm like, why have these 16-year-olds freaking out about dinosaurs? And why have them talking about these ancient ages? What I believe is happening there is that they're talking about the age-old true way of couples attracting each other.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite line in this whole movie is spoken by the son. Where when his dad, you know, is kind of asking, he sees the two of them interacting, and the son says, I saw her, I thought she was pretty, so I talked to her.
Yeah.
That is the key of this movie. That is the message that they're trying to send here. This is right. sort of a weird proto warning against Grindr or whatever. What's the other one? What's the main one?
No, Grindr's the one, Tim. You know that one.
What's the
Tinder?
Yes.
Hinge,
that's what I meant to
Bumble.
Say. I meant to say, yeah. This is which, by the way, none of those things existed at this time. But I think.
No, that seeing the internet in this movie is hilarious.
Oh, right.
Like that web page he opens up. It was this HTML1? Jeez.
But what
right,
I'm saying
up top
is,
on that joke, yeah, Tim, right?
I totally got that. Is that Hotmail? No. Anyhow, you have this little invisible subplot of his son, who is very well adjusted,
yeah.
Who says, like, I just met this girl. Thought she was pretty. I talked to her. And then even later on when his dad asks him, like, hey, how's that going? And he says, well, she's not really who she seemed to be. Which is probably the right way that things should go. You see somebody, you think they're pretty, you talk to them, and then maybe they're not quite the person that you thought that they were, and then maybe you don't pursue that relationship. What you don't do is stage a fake audition to try and trick a woman into being your forever partner. Yeah. So I feel like...
Do what they call today grooming.
That's yes.
Grooming.
So I feel that this movie is sort of saying, look, people are complex. Love is complex. And you can't cheat your way through that. You should go through the age old from all the way back in those dinosaur eras mm-hmm. that has existed from the beginning of time. You see something, it looks good, you approach it.
Right.
That's the way that people should have relationships. Because while we don't know much about he and his wife, we get the impression that they had a very sincere, sweet marriage.
Yes.
We don't know much of anything about it, but we feel that.
There's one shot, and it's pretty early, and it's the first time we're like, oh, that's weird. Where he's, I think he's just talking about the lead actress, and there's like a very quick shot of his wife in her like hospital bed from the beginning of the movie. Because the beginning of the movie, she dies.
Yeah.
In the hospital bed. But it's of her in that bed, and she's sitting straight up and kind of like looking, not really alarmed, but maybe concerned, like wide-eyed.
Right.
Like for half a second, and then it's gone. You're like, the fuck was that?
Right. Yeah.
But there is a lot of subtleness of like the wife is always a presence there. There's that picture on his desk. You know, he'll like turn that when he's talking about the other women he's trying to get. She pops up in a lot of like at the end and is like, get out of this, man.
And if you were going to turn that picture, maybe he's better off than rather than staging a ruse of a fake audition to find a new wife. Maybe he ought to go to some grief counseling about his dead wife.
Right.
And
because he probably didn't set up a fake audition to marry her.
No. Right. Exactly. So that's what I'm getting at. I feel like the heart of this movie is talking about the complexities of love, the complexities of relationships, the complexities of people, and that you can't just... You can't take the easy route. And here's how I'm going to use you as an example, because we're friends and I can do that. When you met the love of your life, her largest claim to fame being Nan of Nan's Sum, you all know her. So when you met her, you started checking the boxes. You saw her.
Uh-huh.
You liked her.
Yeah.
And then you made your mistake. You talk to me.
Yeah, exactly.
And I nearly fucked it up.
No.
Because, I said a lot of nice things about her.
Yeah.
I said, what did I say? I said, she's funny. She's smart. I think you'd really like her. But, dude, she's got a kid.
You didn't even preface it with those three things. I will say that.
Did I lead in?
You were like, hey, and we're here at this new coffee shop. I was like, oh, my God. I was just in there like yesterday. Who's the girl that looks like Uma Thurman? And you're like, oh, that's Nancy. She's great. You should ask her out. She's got a kid, though.
Right. So this proves my point exactly. You did all the right things. You saw her. You liked her. You wanted to talk to her. You instead talked to me. But what did you do after that? You did the right thing.
Then
you talked to her.
Wow.
But what I'm saying is that is doing things the right way. Like that is true love. You saw somebody, you felt something, you ended up talking to her eventually, despite me saying that how despicable it is that she has a child, you know, which in your 20s, look, I we're all dumb and stupid.
Yeah, it's 20 years old. That's that you need to know that.
Well, yeah. And but that's what I'm saying is that I'm not saying that nobody has ever met the love of their life on Tinder or anything. I'm not trying to say that it's easy to meet people in this world. But I do think that it's a major part of this film where they're saying that you can't just cut out a major part of somebody's life. You can't look at a picture. You can't read a quick written essay that they gave and say, oh, I'm going to be dedicated to that person.
Right.
Like there's people are more complex than that. Love is more complex than that. And the fact that you think that you can cheat that all through some ruse of an audition is foolish.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is
and
really.
And he's so enamored by her. Like the audition is not even, he's already picked her before they even do the fake audition.
He should have been asking questions the way that his friend was.
Right.
Which is still
fucked
up. Well,
and that's when the friend is like, no, something's up because he doesn't ask any questions to these ladies. Who auditioned, she comes in like 28th out of 30, and then he's asking about her ballet and the friend's like, I'm sorry, what?
Frankly, I thought there were better looking girls in the picture. Yeah,
way better.
Yeah. But all things aside, she does have a very interesting voice.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes it's just that thing that you're looking for.
Now let me ask you this, because this is a very, very important question when we're talking about this movie. While it's not, I'm not saying it's veiled in any way. Do you feel like you got a clear enough picture of what her abuse was to, I mean, did some of that seem a little strange to you? Like, where are her parents?
Yeah. Which, like, I think is intentional.
And
I don't need to know.
And did this weird dance instructor who we see physically abuse her with burning her with these sticks on the inside of her leg. She talks about the fact that she lost her ability to do ballet because of something with her hip.
Yeah.
And what I wondered about that after a while is if he was sexually abusing her, and that maybe she was, that's a polite way to say, because that's sort of the area,
right,
that maybe she's saying something happened with me down there.
Yeah, because when we see we see the burns on her legs first, and then later on, yeah, they've got a bit where she's a child dancing ballet, and then, yeah, the instructor's like kind of crawling toward her, and she's like sitting on the floor and spreads her legs kind of sexually. It's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, yes.
She does not look scared at all.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
But again, this is one of those moments where you're like, is this what literally happened here?
Right.
Because that's when he burns her with these incense sticks or whatever he's got. But then there's kind of like a replay of that scene later where he's a little, like in this scene, he seems very submissive to her. And then the second time he's like, I'm going to fucking burn you. Like he's the aggressor.
And maybe that, you're right, you make a good point with how open she is to opening her legs like that. And maybe that's sadder than we think. Maybe that what that's trying to say is that she was too young to even understand what was happening to her.
Yeah,
and she's entrusted to this guy to watch over her and, you know, that she would naturally go along with what he does because she's entrusted to him,
right,
or whatever. So that's, it makes it even sadder. So here's the real tough question about this movie though, is for somebody who has experienced this level of abuse, when does that justify actions? And is that enough for you to talk about for 30 seconds while I piss?
Sure. Okay. I mean, I would say, I don't know if anything ever really justifies like torturing someone. It's where you understand, like, you're just not like, oh, this person is just like was raised in a nice house and is just purely like a bored psychopath or something. So, yeah, I guess if you combine trauma in someone's past with their poor behavior as an adult, it's a way you can kind of, I don't even want to say excuse it, but understand it. It doesn't make them just seem like, oh, here's just a person who is naturally crazy. Like they maybe were pushed that way. Or it could be a scenario where they just compounded each other. Maybe she was kind of a crazy little kid. And then being in that environment just really pushed her over the edge. Hmm. Maybe what we were seeing with her and the dance instructor was her being, because it's, you know, she dominates a lot of men in this movie.
You do love your evil kids. And,
oh, my God, I love evil kids. I love both sides of that. I love evil kids killing people, and I love people, like, beating kids up.
Yeah.
I love seeing kids get hurt.
You know what's funny is that...
Emotionally.
No,
but
no,
like a ball to the face or something?
Right.
A rubber ball?
Well, it's like, wasn't it Bernie Mac that said that, you know, a child, any child above 3 years old, stomach in the neck. Like you get anywhere in the stomach in the neck, you know, you can get them. I'm going to be honest with you. I had not thought about that. I thought that the movie was trying so hard to say that her, let's just for lack of a better word, evil comes from the abuse. But what if, because the
way, I don't know if that's really happened to her.
Because the way that, well, that's very interesting. Because that guy too is missing his feet, right? So we
right.
By guy, I mean the dance instructor. So we have to, I mean, it's not just like she, that's a coincidence. Right. Obviously, we're to assume that she did that to him.
Yeah.
So which came first,
did
the chicken or the egg?
Did she decapitate him?
Yeah. And yeah, we see that
That's
too.
Something we never hear about, but we see her do. But she does that as an adult.
You know, I'll tell you, this is one of those movies where as much as I love to overthink things, there are people that have way overthought this movie to the point where I've even read something where there's a point in the movie where they finally have sex in this hotel. They go away for the weekend. And I have heard some people say that they have sex. He proposes to her. And then just is sort of thinking about all of like everything, like literally the rest of the movie, even the bad stuff never happens.
Yeah.
It's just his like guilt or something like that, which
it seemed like that's what it was. I was super pissed for like a minute in this movie where I was like, oh, this is all a dream.
Okay. But I don't think
it was. Then it goes back. And
it has
like,
to.
Nope. Actually, him thinking it was a dream, that part was a dream. Like that shock setting in. And him kind of being like, oh, you know what would have been great if it had just all gone to plan and she would have been like, yeah, I will marry you. Let's have a happy life together.
Yeah.
And then he snaps out of it as, you know.
And maybe the movie is about
Mace's kid.
And maybe it's about like just two wrongs don't make a right. You know, it's like this guy is still not over his wife. She is clearly mentally disturbed to the point of being homicidal. Let me just interject myself real quick here and say that, especially after last week's movie, I found my limit, by the way, in this film.
I know where it is.
I found my limit that I didn't know it existed.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Is it when she feeds her captor?
Oh.
If you haven't seen the movie,
but you have eaten Campbell's corn chowder.
Yeah. The lead actor, Shigaru, like wakes up in her apartment. This is one of those things where you're like, how the fuck did he get here? Is he even really there?
They do it really cool
now,
too.
Yeah. And now mind you, a few times, God, we should just like, because there are a few steps to get here.
Yeah.
Because the first time you really see her in her apartment, she's just kind of like sitting on the floor. She just looks very lonely. Like maybe like, oh, here's a girl who, you know, maybe this will work for them because she has nothing and he needs something. You know, then the next time you see her, she's still and it's just her and like a black phone. And you kind of see like a bag, but it kind of like blends in with stuff. So even the first time around, you really don't notice it. The second time when she's sitting here, this is the part where you're like, okay, she's a little creepy because she will sit in that W way kids sit,
yes.
You know, with their legs out like a W. This time she's sitting, it's really wide. She is hunched over to where like her neck and spine are just doing like a 90 degrees. Mm. It's so weird. The phone rings and the burlap sack takes a leap. It's like eight cats in there and you just scared them. Like this thing pops up and rolls back around. But like that's it. Like you never really could see what's in the bag. Later, you find out because he goes to investigate somewhere at a bar she worked at. And that guy's like, yeah, that place actually closed. Like the owner got killed. And he was like, yeah, chopped up into little pieces. Crazy thing was when like the cops came and like investigated the scene, they found extra body parts. Like there were three extra fingers, a tongue and an ear. So now Shigeru is in her apartment and he's like kind of coming to, and the guy's coming out of the bag, right? And he recognizes, he's like, oh my God, he's missing fingers. He has no tongue. You know, he's just like, he has no tongue. All of a sudden he hears this retching. He turns, Amika, what was her name again? Asami. Asami is like retching over in the corner, and you're just like, what? This place is nuts. That's when she turns Tim with a dish that she has been vomiting in and sets it down in front of the guy from the bag. And man, he goes to town on it. Like it's ambrosia. Oh God. And he has no tongue, so he's just kind of like biting at it.
It kind of weirdly it kind of weirdly reminded me of the homeless guy from Train to Busan, like, but worse off. Way worse off. That is something, and I have a very strong stomach, but that eating of the vomit, like, and it had to be that color and that consistency. I struggled with that. Like, legitimately, I was like
watery vomit too. Yeah, like, no. I almost would rather it be chunky.
Yeah, but it looked like it had like that bile. Pale yellow color of Campbell's soup corn chowder, like the hearty corn chowder. So gross. But the question is he really, like, people start just, and they do it expertly, like ninjas. People show up in a scene that, like, literally the frame has already been established, and then all of a sudden there's somebody else there. Yeah. And you're like, hold up, how did I not see that person? Right. It's amazing. Really well done. So that part is utterly fantastic. And it really took me to the point where I was like, I'm struggling with that more than the stuff that I had heard about with like the severing of limbs and that sort of thing. But that's sort of the question of,
and see all these scenes, like I'm like sitting here thinking like, well, how does he get out of there? But it's not like a linear thing where he's like, oh, here's, you know, like, I don't know if he was definitely even in there. So it's like not even really important how he gets out of that apartment.
And it might even be something where it's like he is putting pieces together.
Right.
But rather than just have him like sitting somewhere being like, oh, maybe she's fucked up. Like they choose to do it in a sort of metaphorical way, like him actually seeing how fucked up she is.
Right.
Which is a metaphor for him realizing how messed up she is.
Yeah.
Because there's even a weird scene where as that guy is eating the vomit, she like for real quick, like turns into a little girl again. And then is like petting him.
Oh yeah. But then she speaks with her adult voice.
Yeah. Oh, it's weird. It's really very cool. But I'll tell you something, I want to get this point out there because it fascinates me that more people don't talk about this as much as they talk about relationships. You know, it's funny, the hot thing right now is narcissist.
Yeah.
Everybody's a narcissist. And a lot of them are, by the way. I'm glad that term.
I know you think you are, Tim.
Right. Yeah. I play it up. That's part of my gig. But a lot of people are narcissists. And when you do, I'm kind of glad that term came to the forefront, because if you start to read about those on a psychological level, you're like, holy fuck. Yeah. That's what that person was like. But here's something that people don't talk about. And I'm shocked by it. There are people out there. Maybe you've known one. There are people out there who, and by the way, when we're talking about relationship stuff in this show, in this episode, I am not speaking about anybody specifically. I like to talk to people about their lives. Some of the things that I say might be gleaned from other people's lives or maybe my experience, but I don't want anybody to be like, is he talking about me? Like, no, it's just talking in general. But one thing that is never really talked about is there are people who 90% of the time are funny, smart, interesting, maybe even sexy,
you talking
charming.
About me? What?
Yes. For a second. Yeah, those things, yes. And they can be all those things to all people. But you get that person in a relationship and they are absolutely psychotic. And you can have a psychotic episode with that person and then go out and meet your friends and they are fine and dandy and everybody loves them. And you come back in and the second that door slams shut, they go right back into it.
Right.
And it's something that people don't talk about because you would think that there wouldn't be people like that. But there are people out there that are so good at selling normalcy outside of the confines of a relationship. But if you're one of those unlucky individuals that gets into one of those with them, it's scary. And yeah. And it, what sucks is that you get pulled in by that 90% and you're like, well, I could just deal with this, but nobody should have to deal with full on fucking crazy.
Right.
And that's what's happening here is this guy is so entranced by her vulnerability and her, what he feels is her honesty. It's not much of honesty.
Yeah.
But, and,
well, and that's the rub. She's like mad at him for lying. And it's like, well, you're kind of a big fucking liar yourself.
Right. And the fact that her big thing is, I asked you to love nobody but me. So the fact that he, God forbid, loves his ex-wife, his dead wife, by yeah. the way, his son,
yeah.
you know, his dog, by the way.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, I know, sweet little beagle.
Dude, I saw the dog in the beginning, and I was just like, I know something's happening to that dog.
Every dog in any movie has about a 3% chance of survival.
Now, jumping on what you were saying about some bits being cartoony, the dead dog... I laughed out loud.
Yeah.
It's kind of sitting there with like its tongue hanging out, which listen, I had a pet that died and its tongue was hanging out of its mouth. Like that probably yeah. just happens, but it just looked like a, oh.
And it, because it was a beagle, you're within your, well within your rights to be like, maybe you shouldn't have been such a bitch about everything all the time. you're cute as hell. That breed is adorable, but they are just little fucking
oh, they're, you have a bad experience with the
well,
beagle?
Well, they just get wound up. Like, they should.
They do.
They get wound up.
Well, you know, they used to be wolves.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a few people in line a little closer to that wolf thing than the beagles. German Shepherd? Okay, do your thing. Be the wolf. Like, I get it. I right. see it. But yeah, no. And now let's go ahead and talk about the last 20 minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
Where it gets real serious, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, cute. When she says the word, it's K-I-R-E, kitty, kitty, yeah, kitty, yeah. which means deeper, 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 which actually, did you read that thing where that wasn't in the script?
Yeah.
That she was just kind of like, sort of like, as they're running through stuff, she's just kind of like saying it to herself.
Yeah.
And they're like, that sounds pretty cool.
It sounds awesome.
It's so cute. It's almost like, yeah, go ahead and stick those needles
yeah,
in his
because
face.
She is, yeah, she's paralyzed. She drugs his whiskey.
Yeah.
Breaks
loves
into his house.
Loves his whiskey,
loves
by
his
the
whiskey.
Way.
He's got a great decanter that he just kind of leaves wherever. It's like by a window.
This episode scene. Brought to you by Suntory Japanese Whiskey.
But yeah, she like drugs his whiskey. He passes out and he, you know, or I guess not really passes out, but he's like, he's paralyzed.
Yeah.
And that's when he sees her like in the smock, the rubber smock, which is awesome. It's such a good get, like, it's like a mad scientist get up. It's so good.
A little
like,
hot. Yeah.
It is kind of hot. I'll agree with you on that one. But yeah, and she just gets fucking surgical and clinical on him. And is like first administers some other sort of agent that's like, she's like, this is going to make your nerves alive. Like you're paralyzed, but you can still feel pain.
Yeah.
And she just starts like, she just has like acupuncture needles and she's just poking them, which they're, you know, they're fine needles. Like they don't hurt, but I would assume in this circumstances, because he is like,
ah! Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, as she's just bending over, is just going,
kitty, 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 kitty. So cute.
It's so funny.
As she's putting needles in his eyes.
His eyes. Like, yeah, the soft part under the eye.
Yeah.
Like, I almost think that's, I was like, oh, she's putting them in his eye. But no, not even. Like, just, and not, I almost all thought she was going to do the lids to keep them open or something. Yeah. But no, just like, and just like three. Just like, not really any rhyme or reason. There is a part, though, she's got so many in his stomach,
yeah.
and then she, like, scooches up onto his chest, and I'm just like, oh, she probably, like, broke all of those off inside yeah. of him.
Oh, man. It's good stuff. And I'll tell you.
That's not even the half of it.
No. And I'll tell you, it's we watch a lot of gore, and I was really excited at that part because –
We're like, finally.
I felt, yeah, well, yeah, that, and I felt like it's, it be, I like that you use the word surgical almost. Like, it, she has such a precision about it, and the helplessness is, he does a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
We don't know what somebody looks like when they're paralyzed, but they can feel everything. But, like, it's almost like, I don't even know what the right word is. Like sad when you see like some like limbs, like his hand will flop around.
Yeah.
And you know that that's taking a maximum effort of his entire
all
body.
All he can do is like just roll and his wrist around a little bit.
It's like almost, it's humiliating that he's even trying. So then she gets out the piano wire, which this movie might.
Is it piano? I don't even know. Is it piano wire?
Piano wire.
Any kind of wire. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Specifically, well, yeah, I believe that it's, yeah. So
still, in any way, wire.
Right, right. Which makes sense with the dance instructor and stuff like that, that that might have been handy at that time because he's playing piano.
Oh, right.
Right. So, okay. So what's really fun about this is you would think that if somebody was going to get their foot severed by a piano wire, that the best part as like a gore hound, as a horror fan, would be the severing of the foot itself. Not so much that as the thump that it makes when she just tosses it aside.
And I love that shot because, yeah, we are inside with them the whole time. And this one shot is kind of from outside, which you it just looks like it's from a distance, but she just casually tosses a foot and it hits the window. So then we're just, yeah, you hear the thump and we're left with that blood smear that we have to look at for a couple more seconds before then we come back in the house with them. It's the only shot that's like outside of the scene. And it's funny.
Picture when you come home drunk from the bar and you get into bed in your clothes and you just take off your shoes and like just toss them somewhere.
Yes,
like that. That guy is never going to have a foot forever for the rest of his life. But she just kind of.
Well, they might be able to get it back on.
Really?
Sure.
Can they attach a foot, a severed foot, a completely severed foot?
I mean, if it's fresh enough. Yeah. You can do a finger. So why couldn't you do a foot?
I hope so.
Now, I mean. We've covered Pet Sematary before. That thing went through that Achilles, and that's the worst part thinking about it.
Yeah, but the gore is handled in a way that I think what amplifies the scene is that the director, the character itself, herself, we're just taking time with it.
Yeah,
she's going about it, and I hate as an actor.
When we first see her, when she uses the wire to behead the dance instructor, it goes very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, well, the end is, it's kind of drawn out at the beginning, like when it first starts cutting in, but then she's just like, whoop, gone through it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the foot is like working at it.
Oh, yeah.
You get that hereditary, like,
yeah, oh, yes. Yes. And you know, that's the stuff that gets me, like that sort of helpless. Like, it's one thing if you're fighting. You know, you see a scene where somebody's fighting off an assailant and they've got a chainsaw or a knife or a machete or whatever, but you feel like there's a chance, but this guy is just incapacitated completely. And so then his poor son comes home. Now, what the hell do you think that spray is?
I don't know. I like read it was supposed to be mace, but yeah, I don't know. Cause she's like, I first thought it was like chloroform, like, oh, she's going to spray that into a cloth or something, but no, she like, just comes up behind him like she's an aggressive, like, perfume counter worker. And Carson Peary Scott, you know? It's like,
I would let myself get sprayed by that. I just would. You got that, get whatever that. What? How did you describe it? It's like a leather apron that she has.
Yeah, a smock.
Spray whatever you want in my face. But I'll tell you, Dr. Brian, is there such a thing as a spray chloroform? Yeah. And if so, Ted Bundy, you know, damn his soul to hell, is really excited at the advent of
that.
And
it's in like a very nice, like, it looks like a thing you get at like.
A designer.
Thank you. Designer is the word I was looking for.
Yeah, like a designer chloroform.
Yeah, yeah. Like a gift you get someone for Chris, just like, I saw that, it looked nice.
Right.
You can put your chloroform in it and spray people.
I didn't get you any presents, so I'm just going to chloroform your ass, and then it's going to be like 2 days after Christmas, and who gives a shit? All of that is carried out very well, but it's not even the most heartbreaking part of that scene.
No.
What is so gorgeous and romance and sentiment is never better done in film than when it's done simply. And she is eventually kicked down the stairs, and boy, oh boy, does she get a good
time in
kick.
A movie where I'm like, the obvious thing here is to do this, and then they immediately do it.
Yes.
Because she chases him up the stairs. I'm like, kick her down the stairs, and he just fucking launches her.
He launches. There's no like down the stairs.
No,
launches her for the length.
Every stair. Yeah.
The length of the stairs. She hits the ground, and probably the best broken neck I've ever seen on film.
Oh,
ever.
Yeah.
To where, like, usually when someone breaks their neck, quote unquote, on screen, there's no change. You're just like, oh, they're dead now, and their head is to the side.
Yeah.
Like, literally, you see a bone pushing the skin up.
Well, see, that's another thing. Yeah, her neck starts swelling, so I felt like that was another, like, is that really happening?
Yeah, I think that was the bone. Like, her neck snapped, and the bone is pushing the skin out. My dad one time saw a kid.
Because it looked like it was pulsing, though.
Yeah, well, there might have been some action there. My dad saw a kid once that shot himself through the side of the head, and he saw the bullet hadn't penetrated the skin, but it was pushing the skin out. He could see the formation of the bullet on the other side.
Wow.
When he's an EMT. So she's got a broken neck. But here's the poignant part. He is still very much paralyzed, still one less foot than he used to have. Still needles in the skin. His son has no idea what the fuck is going on. Right. Walks into all of this madness, by the way, but somehow manages to kill her. But whether it is actually happening or not, probably not, no, because probably she's not. Dead.
Yeah.
But we see her repeating these, what seemed like kind of just innocent throwaway lines from earlier in the film. And it is the sweetest thing. It's, I don't know if maybe you have to go to the extent of showing death to make these lines hit as hard as they do. Because if she had said them to him and they were standing at an altar and she was a perfectly normal person, I don't think it would have hit as hard.
Right.
The fact that she's saying these things, like, I don't even remember what the lines are, but it's like, you know, something like, I, you're the only one that, you know, pays attention to me, or like, I feel so happy that when I'm with you, like just the simplest things, extremely affecting. And I just felt like, while I'm not going to try to twist it into some beautiful love story because it isn't, but it made you feel bad for the victim of somebody who was treated in a way that they didn't deserve.
Yeah.
Who acts in a way that is not acceptable, but did that person ever have a chance?
Yeah.
Did they ever have a chance in life when you've been abused that badly?
Yeah.
It's way more than anybody ever bargains for when they watch a horror film. So fucking good.
Yeah.
So good. I'm trying not to get worked up here because it's so affecting that I'm not gonna get upset about it, but it's just like, I just thought that it to me, it's, I'm not even getting worked up about the subject. I just think that, I don't know. I thought that the movie was, I don't even know what to say right now. I was just very taken.
I'll say, ever since I've had daughters, I fucking love a movie where a woman gets revenge on a creepy guy. So this movie really worked for me. There are some others. What was that? There was a new one with Bo Burnham was in it. Oh, god damn. I can't remember what it's called now. It was like on Hulu. It was A Fine Young Woman or something like that. Shit, I can't remember what it was. Start a Woman. I really didn't pay that much attention to it. No, it was a really good movie.
I guess what I'm saying is
I love a good,
I pulled myself out of my emotional moment.
Okay, thank
I guess
God.
What I, I'm guess I'm sorry. I guess what I'm saying is I don't mean to be indulgent emotionally that way, but it just speaks to the testament of, you know, or it's a testament to how affecting that is. I guess what I'm saying is most movies that would go for example, the end of the movie Death Proof.
Uh-huh.
If we're going to give the audience a revenge scene, then we're just going to like go all in, on that whole like power move, like here it comes. I'm avenging myself. I'm avenging my abuse. I'm going to kick ass. And we want to like a stand up and cheer moment.
Yeah.
But for it to turn into something sweeter and sadder, I thought was like it is the sweetness that we didn't even know that we needed and that we probably didn't even deserve. And that that they turned it into that. And that's just, I spent so much of this movie thinking like, yeah, it's cool. It's great. I like it. There's great performances. And then even in that last 20 minutes, I'm like, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. This is some awesome gore. This is fun. But for them to dish out that last little bit at the end, that's what made me think that this movie isn't about cutting somebody's foot off. It's not even about the audition or feminism or misogyny or anything like that. It's about just the complexities of love,
yeah,
of people,
yeah,
let alone love, before you even get to love, the complexity of people. I think that I hate saying this, but as the world evolves, I think one of the better parts of it are that we are maybe becoming a little bit more aware of the struggles that people go through,
yeah,
that we would have dismissed before. So kudos to this movie for catching that in 1999.
Promising Young Woman is the name of the movie I was thinking of. Carey Mulligan. Carey Mulligan? Yeah. It's a good movie.
Does everybody have their feet at the end?
Yes, they okay. do. I mean, well, you know, one of them gets the rug swept out from under them. It's a depressing ending.
Is it?
It is. But it's a good movie.
Do you like depressing movies?
Yeah, you know, I like to cry.
Well, let me ask you this.
I guess that's different.
When you and I don't want to jump topics because the Lord knows we talked about it enough, but when you watch something like Synecdoche, what are you getting out of that?
I mean, there's a part of me that just kind of like, first and foremost, is just blown away that someone is able to articulate those types of feelings that everyone is either feels or is going to feel about the eventuality of their own death, and able to express it in such a unique and creative and straightforward way. I mean, just the you know, movie nerd in me there is just like, wow, what an achievement.
Yeah.
But yeah, also I like thinking about, you know, I wish everyone else kind of like recognized the eventuality of their own death and what we do here. There's definite impact on it. There's that, and it's not, you know, when the blackout of the movie comes, there's no post-credit scene. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. But you make it that.
So I like.
But couldn't you say this? If let's go with that metaphor. Uh-huh. If every movie eventually ends, if every bouquet of flowers eventually dies, does that mean that we don't appreciate it along the
exactly.
way?
Exactly. No. That's why you should take care of those flowers. Don't let them die prematurely.
Okay. So what you're saying is that through an honest awareness,
yeah,
of what the end brings,
yeah,
that should inspire you to maybe be better or less egotistical or whatever.
Because this is it.
Yeah.
You don't get to then in a different life be like, sorry about all that shit back there. I was just kind of in my head a little bit, you know.
Right. You know what, though?
There's no opportunity to do that.
You know what, though? I really hope in my, and I know your belief system. In my belief system, there is.
I don't have one, but sure. Right.
But I believe that there is something else. And I hope that when that happens, that I see you and I'm just like, like, gotcha. Like, you would have never called this, but here we are, you know? But yeah, no, I think that these movies have a place. I think that they certainly have a place in horror, and I really wish that there were more, because I think that this genre, which I've talked about before, like, remember when I was talking a handful of episodes ago about no other genre can do what horror can do?
Yeah.
That I think that if there were more movies like this, that if people saw the emotional potential for horror,
yeah,
that it would get a lot more respect.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's also the cool thing about horror is you can have a movie like this that's like no horror for 80% of it, but I'm still going to be like, yeah, that's a horror movie.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And none of that 20 minutes, I mean, anybody cutting somebody's foot off is always going to be horrific. Anybody eating vomit is always going to be gross. But does any of that present itself as strongly as it does without that first hour and a half?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because I was thinking about what if this was the movie I thought it would be? Well, then it'd be like Boxing Helena, a movie I saw once and didn't like very much.
Okay. You know? So I see what you're saying. And I don't mean to bring up a contentious topic, but you're saying that if a Serbian film had maybe, whereas you felt it was throwing stuff at the screen just to throw it at it,
yeah,
if it had maybe contained some of that a little bit more for the end, that maybe it could have been, it would have hit harder.
I don't know. I mean,
you just don't want to feel cheated.
Different stories. Those are two different movies and different stories.
Yeah.
I just like this story a lot better. I said this to you before we went on air. We were talking about Blue Movie, the Jenna Jameson film that I owned as a young man.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, that movie's like a Serbian film where it's like, okay, here is a movie that is just like beginning to end this kind of trash, but it's shot very well. And the performances in him for porno,
sure,
are good.
Yeah.
It's a well-constructed film, but I'm not going to be like, watch this. Not going to be full of anything you want to see, but it looks nice.
Okay.
Got a nice polish on it.
Let me hit you with a little curveball. Where are we at for time?
I mean, we should be wrapping it up.
Okay.
Soon
here. But I'm going to hit you with a curveball that both of us, myself included, have forgotten until this point.
Okay.
And I think it deserves mention because I wonder what the fuck is going on with it. What is up with the assistant at his job?
Oh, yeah. I meant to bring her up. I liked her, too, because she is the person who's there, who's like, because, yeah, it's alluded to. She, you know,
she's like a secretary at where he works or whatever.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if she works directly under him or whatever. But, yeah, they definitely work together. And she's the person who's, you know, it's revealed later, like, that they slept together one time.
Right.
And it didn't work out. But to her, she's like, hey, like, she's the woman at the bar. Like, hey, like, I'm right here.
Yeah.
Like, we actually shared one of these moments you've been looking for. And, yeah, I get it. I'm not, like, 25 years old because she's got, like, some bags under her eyes.
Right. So you're saying she's
ugly.
So you're saying she represents kind of like Chloe Sevigny's character in American Psycho. Like, here's a nice girl that's right in front of you.
Yes.
That you are too blind to see is perfect for you and is a wonderful person.
Yeah.
Like, it's so,
you're already too wrapped up in your own perceptions of
So earlier in the movie, when this character tells our male lead that she's getting married, it kind of seems a little out of nowhere. And even to him, it seems a little out of nowhere. But maybe what's happening in that scene is that maybe she does have some unrequited feelings for him, and she's saying it to him, and he's giving her no reaction. Yeah,
like, maybe he'll be like, what?
Right. In the same way where later in the movie, she's like, okay, I'm leaving, and he's just kind of not even paying attention. And she's such a seemingly throwaway character, but maybe that just adds to what I'm saying about what I feel is the essence of the movie, which is that, you know, here she is, somebody that he sees, that he knows, that he could talk to, that he interacts with, that maybe, God, I hate to even say it, even his maid. Like, his maid would be a better mate for him. Right. And she even kind of gives him a little bit of, I mean, she doesn't come on to him, but she's kind of like, boy, if my husband were like you, what I couldn't have done in this world. But I think that that's kind of what the movie is saying, is that getting blinded by what you perceive to be the perfect thing, or the ideal mate or whatever, that don't miss what's happening right in front of you naturally. That could be the right thing.
Yeah.
Just because you're fixated on something else.
Yeah.
Which essentially was his dead wife.
Yeah.
So
you figured it out.
it's a relationship movie. I mean, it's about relationship. Yeah. I really think that that's what it is.
Also, quickly, I'm going to point out, if I saw you in the afterlife, I would reluctantly acknowledge the afterlife and not sit there and deny it because it inconvenienced me.
And make comment that I still somehow had a fur on in the afterlife.
Oh, yeah. I'd like, be like, yeah. Korg's here?
it's humans and, like, minks. Like, that's what made it over.
They're like, this is heaven? I'm just being killed and stripped for my fur.
Yeah. So, this movie, I highly recommend it. And I'm kind of ashamed that I didn't see it sooner because I know that, again, a lot of folks have seen it. A lot of folks love it. Great movie. How the hell do you not recommend it?
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. It was awesome. And it's a nice, slow burn. And it wasn't anything that I thought it was going to be. So maybe that's why I liked it a lot more. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm interested to know, and I'm not saying this because I already have an idea. I'm interested to know what a second viewing brings.
Yeah, well.
I'm not saying I'm rushing out.
I
mean,
I own it now because I went to rent it, and you could rent it for $3.99 or buy it for $2.99. I was like, I guess I own this movie now.
What other movie did we buy that? Oh, I bought Truth or Dare.
Yeah, and I bought The Burning on Blu-ray.
Oh, that's the worst. The worst. Oh, well, at least you can enjoy this one another time, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I will.
Yeah.
There are definitely some scenes I want to revisit.
And this might be, like, I don't know how to paint this. Like, I don't want to say, like, hoity-toity or whatever. But if there are people that listen to the show that, like, a run-of-the-mill slasher doesn't work for them, and usually they go for more complex foreign films or indie films or whatever, this is going to fit that.
Yeah.
Yes, people get really fucking tortured and killed at the end, but it's going to hit that flavor that you like if you're a big foreign film, independent film person.
Yeah.
It's got that feel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome. Good movie. Okay. So that was Audition 1999. Join us next week. Nice little palate cleanser. This is going to be a good time. From 1987, The Lost Boys.
Imagine as a filmmaker, you've had some success. You've made some movies. People know who you are. But in your quiet moments, when you're being the most honest with yourself, that you know that a good portion of your fame comes from the fact that you cast a shirtless saxophone player with chains. And that's what we're really thinking about.
Hey, I don't remember that.
What?
Well, listen, it's been a long time since I've seen it.
Oh, okay, I won't say anything more.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm looking forward.
Oh, my God. Okay.
But yeah, I probably have not seen this movie in like 20 years.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
If shirtless, oily saxophone player doesn't ring a bell, boy, it's gonna. It's gonna.
Now I'm worried. Because, yeah, you suggested we do this as our palate cleanser. We were going to do either Gremlins 2 or The Burbs. Please write in if you'd like us to cover either of those movies, which we will eventually, I'm sure. But yeah, you said, how about The Lost Boys, which Nan had just said like 2 days ago, like, you guys should do The Lost Boys. And I was like, oh, I'd love to. And she's like, and she was surprised. Like, she said it as a joke.
Yeah.
Because she's like, it's so 80s. Like, you hate the 80s. I'm like, yeah, but I fucking loved The Lost Boys.
Yes.
But now that you're saying saxophone player, I'm a little nervous.
Oh, he's coming for you.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And not like a fun, sexy sax man like the internet guy, but
maybe
an inspiration for that guy.
I mean, a lot of hips.
Oh, my God.
A lot of oil.
Yeah. What?
Oh, you'll see.
Was he like a character?
You'll see.
All right. Yeah, I don't want to know.
Everybody else, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Literally every other human listening to this right now knows exactly what I'm talking about. I cannot wait for you to see it.
I forgot Tommy Lee Jones was in Natural Born Killers, so I'm not shocked I ever got a saxophone player from a movie I haven't seen in 20 years.
That's true.
Okay, so yes, join us next week for The Lost Boys. I didn't write all my – I remember it all. Check out our website, Slumber Podcast, massacre.com. Shoot us an email. Fuck it. You know the routine. shoot us an email, slumberpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our Twitch stream. I started streaming, hopefully a little regularly. We're doing Tuesdays and Thursdays. I just did a whole playthrough of the game, Little Nightmares. Tim, I got like alert noises and stuff. Oh, here's something I want to tell you real quick, yes. A crazy thing. Because when you like follow a channel or something, you can have it play like a little sound effect. So I have like a bunch of different quotes based on whatever happens on the channel. Hopefully someone watches and these things start happening. That'd be great. But anyway, I was looking up it clips. I'm like, if I could use like an old clip from the TV miniseries.
Yes.
And I came upon this scene where it's Bill is an adult and he goes back to Georgie's grave. It's when he's come back to Derry, uh-huh. And he's in the cemetery, and then Pennywise is there in the cemetery, and he's got all these open graves, and he's like, take your pick, except the one at the end, because Stan has killed himself.
Yes.
But they show it, and it's a grave with a big cross on it. And I'm like, wait, Stan's Jewish.
Oh,
like, fuck you, Pennywise. Like, yeah. How evil are you?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So, I don't know if that was that can't have been intentional. That was just like lazy. Just like, yeah, it's like a grave. You put a fucking cross at it.
Jesus was Jewish, right? King of the Jews, even. Yeah.
I thought that was hilarious. We forgot to cover that when we talked about it way back then. But yeah, check out our Twitch stream. All the other shit, YouTube, Twitter, blah, 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 Instagram. Huge thanks to our patrons. You help make this show possible. We're indebted to you. Thank you so much. Tim, do you have anything else to say about Audition?
Well, not about Audition necessarily, and I don't want to be too ahead of things, but just because I'm starting to see more press for it, ladies and gentlemen who listen to the show, obviously you're probably horror fans. Get out there whenever the release date does come for Justin Long's next movie called
Barbarian.
Is it Barbarians or maybe. Barbarian?
I don't know.
Okay. Look up Barbarian. Yeah. Right?
Don't get confused by if there is.
And I thought of it because it also stars.
Oh, Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah. Who played Pennywise. So definitely look for that because we want to generate some buzz for that movie and something might just come of that.
Yeah, maybe we'll give Justin a little bump.
Yeah.
Like, why'd my movie do so well? Right. Slumber Podcast Massacre has been talking about it a lot.
Yes, and that means everything.
All right, Tim, well, I got to say is, can I borrow this chair? Bye!
Bye!